Today on the Best of Flashpoints, two local Arizona reporters win the Pulitzer Prize for breaking the story of the racist sheriff, Joseph Arpaio. We'll talk to one of the prize winners. Nora Bears Friedman reports from the occupied West Bank on Earth Day. We also feature a remembrance of the legendary work of UFW founder Cesar Chavez by his friend and co-organizer Jose Montoya. All this coming up on the Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We turn our attention back to Sheriff Joe Arpaio and the situation of immigration in Arizona. For more than 2 years, Sheriff Joe Arpaio has dispatched his deputies to arrest hundreds of illegal immigrants as he's retooled his force into an immigration enforcement agency. And so writes one of two Pulitzer Prize winning reporters now, Ryan Gabrielson and Paul Giblin. And in a lead to their initial story, it goes on to say, but it's Maricopa County's residents, particularly those living in small towns and rural stretches, who have paid the price for his decision. People wait for longer times for deputies to arrive at life-threatening emergencies. Detectives make arrests in far fewer criminal investigations. Taxpayers are spending millions of dollars to enforce federal immigration laws. And so it is written today, reporters Ryan Gabrielson and Paul Giblin of the East Valley Tribune in Mesa, Arizona. Giblin is now with Arizona Guardian, were awarded a Pulitzer Prize for their local reporting on the Maricopa County Sheriff. Over the past several years, it says from the Pulitzer people, Sheriff Joe has transformed his police department into an immigration enforcement agency, running up costs, conducting large-scale neighborhood sweeps, and neglecting other crime-fighting activities. The award-winning series revealed the sheriff's, quote, focus on immigration enforcement and how it endangered investigation of violent crime, as we said, and other public safety. And we are delighted to have with us Paul Giblin. Mr. Giblin, welcome to Flashpoints and congratulations.
Well, thank you, Dennis. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And, well, tell us, what got you started on the sheriff and why did you think he needed a serious investigation?
Well, the sheriff is a guy who gets lots and lots of press coverage. Everything from dressing people and prisoners in pink underwear to the neon vacant sign above Tent City Jail. So the guy has no shortage of press coverage, but he wasn't getting any really good detailed analysis. So we thought it was time to change his kind of press coverage to that tact.
All right, and talk a little bit more about the kinds of tactics that he used that got people's attention. You mentioned the pink underwear. He literally dressed prisoners in pink underwear. I think he had pink handcuffs. And how did he justify this? Tell us more about him.
Well, he says that the prisoners were stealing socks and underwear, so he dyed them pink so that they wouldn't steal them some more. Other people might say, how are prisoners stealing underwear from jails in the first place? But he got away with doing the pink underwear and the pink handcuffs, as you mentioned, and then he did other things. He took away coffee from the jails. He took away salt and pepper. He tried taking away their cable TV, but the Supreme Court said they had to have cable TV, so I think he gives them C-SPAN and the Weather Channel or something like that. So he does all these kinds of crazy antics all the time. He has chain gangs and women chain gangs, and so he gets a lot of press coverage.
Women chain gangs. And what do these chain gangs do? Do they march through the streets? Do they march together to work sites?
They're literally chained up, and then they go around Arizona, usually are along street sides, and they pick up litter. It's just a bunch of drug offenders, usually, who pick up litter. So that's what they do on the chain gang most of the time.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Paul Giblin. He was formerly with the East Valley Tribune in Mesa, small daily paper that has now been awarded the Pulitzer Prize for reporting done by our guest and also his partner, Ryan Gabrielson. Now, just a side note, you were fired from the East Valley Tribune after you published the story?
Almost. I was laid off. The Tribune laid off half of their news staff in January. So I was among the half. And in fact, Patty Epper, our editor on the project, was also among the half the people who were laid off. So that's true.
And this wasn't political. They just didn't have the money, or did they not like the story?
No, it didn't have anything to do with the story. It had to do with newspaper finances that you see all over the country, Denver and Seattle and Tucson and Chicago. I mean, these massive layoffs of papers all over the country are happening, and it caught up to us here in Arizona.
Now, I understand that there were many brutal moments and a lot of questions, in fact, a lot of lawsuits about the brutality imposed upon those prisoners who ended up in the jurisdiction with Sheriff Arpaio. You want to talk a little bit? Give us some examples of that.
Well, a recent one, there was a prisoner who was beaten to death. It was all caught on videotape within the jail. The story goes that it was part of the Ryan Brotherhood, which is this white supremacist gang within the jail, and they had some sort of gang trial, and they wanted to punish this fellow, and so they beat him to death in the jail. One inmate disputes the other guy on videotape, and then they were on a second story part of the jail, and so he tried throwing him over the balcony. He was probably dead at that point, but he couldn't get the body over, so he just left it there and then went down to the lower level to await being arrested within the jail, and then finally the guards in their SWAT gear came in and arrested him. There's that kind of thing, and other prisoners have died.
What do we know in terms of many have claimed the Flashpoints team? This show was in Phoenix recently for a protest against the sheriff, and many used the word racist. Many used other words to describe him. Brutal was among them. Racist?
That is now getting a little bit closer to what our project was. Our project, we focused on the illegal immigration enforcement operation that Arpaio does. As you mentioned during the intro, he has changed his police operation. It's a sheriff's office, but provides police protection for people in Maricopa County. And he started doing this federal enforcement of illegal immigration. So he would pick up suspected illegal immigrants as they were going through rural highways on their way to Los Angeles and to Las Vegas, which are two hubs for distribution throughout the country. And then he would go into neighborhoods searching out these illegal immigrants. He would just go into the neighborhoods and arrest people who had broken taillights and that sort of thing. And his critics charge that's a form of racism and civil rights violations or racial profiling.
He also broke up families so that little kids were left to fend for themselves. People didn't know where their brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers were.
That's happened numerous times.
Give us a couple of examples so people understand what was going on there.
One that comes to mind is there was a grandfather and a son. The grandfather was arrested for being an illegal immigrant, and the grandson was left here. There's also another case in which a woman who had two children, she was arrested for being an illegal immigrant. And now you get into the issue of birthright citizenship. A lot of these people who are illegal immigrants come over, they have children here, and they are birthright citizens, so the parents get shipped back to Mexico or wherever they came from, and the children sometimes stay.
Now, there have been a series of investigations, lawsuits. Do you think that the sheriff has gone to the point where he could be prosecuted for federal civil rights violations? I'm not asking if you think. What do you know about his actions that could lead to prosecution?
Well, right now the FBI is investigating for civil rights violations. The Department of Justice is investigating for the same thing. The U.S. House Judiciary Committee has opened a series of investigative hearings all concerning civil rights violations. So I don't want to predict where any of those three investigations are going, but there's a lot of people looking over your shoulder right now.
Did you make some people angry? After all, the sheriff was an elected official. Did people resent the fact that you were trying to expose some of the potentially illegal aspects and brutal aspects of his work?
Well, Dennis, I don't have to tell you that immigration is, much like the name of your program, it's a flashpoint. People react strongly to immigration, either for or against it. And while our work focused not on immigration policy, it didn't focus on whether it's a good idea to have illegal immigration or that sort of thing. We just looked at his operation, and we looked at what were the consequences that taxpayers might not have realized that they were paying. For instance, because so much manpower was focused on this illegal immigration operation, rapes just went uninvestigated. Ryan and I sat in a police department meeting room and looking at some old rapes that he should have been investigated while the sheriff's department was providing police protection for that particular suburb of Phoenix. But these rapes just simply went uninvestigated, just no one investigating them. And then when the city took over, it created its own police department. They couldn't follow up on those things because they were 18 months old. So there's things like that. Response calls to 911 calls for people who live in the rural areas that the sheriff's department patrols, those skyrocketed. And those are the kinds of things that we found.
What about this idea of deputizing citizens? Some would say arming citizens and creating vigilante organizations. Did that really happen? What was the impact of that?
He does have this posse, which is just people, a lot of them are retired, and they show up at crime scenes. For instance, on the immigration sweeps, the posse members, you'll see them after they arrest a person for a broken taillight or for a bumper hitch in the way of the license plate and makes the license plate unreadable, allegedly. They'll pull over the car, and they'll talk to the driver in the car, and they'll determine that person is a likely illegal immigrant. So that person will be arrested, and then the posse member will babysit the car until a tow truck shows up. So that's the kind of work that the posse does. They also show up at the shopping malls around Christmas time and walk around the parking lots to reassure people that there's not thieves running around, that sort of thing.
Middle of the night raids, confrontations between the sheriff's men and local police, any problems like that?
Well, there's that. The case that comes to mind involves Mesa. The mayor of Mesa and the police chief of Mesa have been critical against the sheriff. So he did a raid of the city hall and of the library looking for custodians who he believed to be illegal immigrants. He brought in about 60 people in riot gear to raid these two buildings at night. He didn't tell the Mesa Police Department that they were coming. In fact, it was a Mesa police officer who found 60 people in riot gear in a park outside City Hall, and that caused some headaches because they were unaware that there were 60 people with submachine guns running around their city that night. So that's kind of typical of what's happening here.
All right. Well, I want to, again, congratulate you, Paul Giblin, along with your partner, Ryan Gabrielson. The two of you won the Pulitzer Prize. It was given to you today for your reporting in the East Valley Tribune, where you no longer work, but you have started your own independent operation, the Arizona Guardian.
Yes, with the editor of that project, a woman named Patty Epler, and two other outstanding reporters, formerly of the Tribune, Mary Kay Reinhart, and another guy named Dennis Welsh. We formed the Arizona Guardian, which is an online news site that covers Arizona state government and state politics, and it's www.arizonaguardian.com.
Give that to us one more time.
It's www.arizonaguardian.com. We're trying to keep journalism alive, and we're having a lot of fun with it. We're doing a pretty good job of covering state government.
Well, I'm going to put it on my bookmark, the Arizona Guardian. Again, you are on my permanent bookmark, and congratulations for your Pulitzer Prize.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being on your program.
And you're listening to Flashpoints. We're going to play you just a bit of sound from our recent visit. And we heard from a Native American leader and organizer of a protest to arrest Sheriff Arpaio. Listen to this.
Bueno, mi nombre es Notoka Tupac Enrique Acosta y Ocasca, Tatoka Navacali y Iscaloteca, Mexica Azteca, Abiyayala, Kamanawak, Tlantzintlali. My name is Tupac Enrique. We are going to make a coincidence today and arrest Sheriff Joe Arpaio. We are going to arrest Sheriff Joe Arpaio with this march. We are going to stop him. We are going to stop his activities. We are going to stop his actions of disrespect and lack of respect for human rights. But according to our jurisprudence and our system of tradition of law and obligation, our purpose is not to punish. Our purpose is to correct and bring it to balance. And for that reason, as we arrest the county of Maricopa and their sheriff, the purpose is to liberate from that jail of ignorance where the house of fear has established itself to dictate policy that is destructive to our relationship as human beings relatives on this Mother Earth of which we represent the original nations.
In the occupied West Bank in Palestine, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This Earth Day in occupied Palestine, the last rain has finished its wet sweep over the ancient land as carpets of deep red hanun, or ranunculus flowers, burst into another sparkling spring. But even within the renewed grace of a turning season, Israel's 62-year-old colonial military occupation disfigures the scenery as Palestinians lose their land to Israeli settlement colonies in the West Bank, bury another family member in the wrecked open-air prison of Gaza, or wait for hours at Israeli checkpoints and years inside prisons. As always in this part of the world, exquisite beauty and bottomless despair interweave. Together they become a living, breathing microcosm of the human capacity for both unmitigated suffering and resourceful tenacity. The Wadi, desert valley near the Bustan Karaka farm in Beit Sahur was, hundreds of years ago, home to a thicket of oak and pistachio trees, one of innumerable and vast forests that stretch from modern-day Lebanon down to the Sinai. Today, the Wadi is a tumble of sparse, cream-colored hillsides that sprout a few sun-bleached bushes and some scraggly 200-year-old olive trees clinging tenuously to the sandy rocks. The physical violence of the many occupations and conquests of Palestine, together with over-farming, regional toxic pollution, and global climate change, is accelerating the desertification of this Wadi and many others like it. And, noticing the mandatory need for both sustainable environmental adaptation and collective resistance to the current Israeli stranglehold, Palestinians have begun to regreen the land, reclaiming the ancient ways of growing crops and going off the grid, using what we in the States would call doctrines of permaculture. Back in Berkeley, California, the idea and practice of permaculture exists in sort of a hippie elite framework. Even though the theory of permaculture mostly revolves around a reconnection to indigenous land practices that have been lost, forgotten, or supplanted by the rise of agri-industrial capitalism, the corporatized overproduction of food, the saturation of farmland with chemicals and pollutants, and monocropping, the movement itself is one of decided convenience, an alternative to the mainstream food and lifestyle structures offered by Safeway and Walmart. We can choose to buy Chilean-grown tomatoes from the store, or we can plant tomato seeds in our gardens if we have time and land to do so. Though it is a righteous and valuable movement, one that encourages self-sufficiency and respect for the land and its delicate and forgiving systems, and we get to feel good about ourselves when we serve a garden-grown salad to our dinner guests, Palestinians under military occupation here see it as a necessary means of empowerment and food security within an ever-changing and uncertain landscape. Palestinians in the area say they are excited about this regreening movement. Munther is a volunteer at the Bustan Karaka farm.
My name is Munther. And I love this place very much. It's a special place for me. Well, actually, because I live here, I am born here. Then all my memories, it's here. So I cannot never leave this place alone. So I come here all the time. I am here. So as I told you, I love this place very much, just like this.
It's so quiet. It's amazing. It kind of reminds me of what Palestine probably was like before the occupations of even the Ottomans. I mean, it's very, like, nothing's moving. It's all very still, and it smells great. How does it feel for you to walk around this kind of place, see things growing, and know that it's part of something bigger?
Yes. First, thank you. You said it's quiet. Yes, it's very, very, very quiet and make me relax. So I come here every Sunday to relax. And also, as you can see, the agriculture, everything it's grown. In the summer, you can see everything, it's green. It's amazing color for us, really.
How does this kind of farm and this kind of practices within this farm, in this community, how does that help the Palestinian struggle?
Yes, it's help very much. The first thing that what my grandfather had do it in this ground. So I am here to learn a new way to be a farmer, good farmer. So it's a beautiful thing that can help many Palestinians. So come here, just learn a new way to have a farm.
What's your favorite thing to plant and grow here?
Everything really. Everything, it's very beautiful. So it's a very beautiful place. Everything become from the seed and become to big trees. So you can see this day by day, year by year.
Because of the occupation, because of the settlements, and because of the wall, and because of the lack of water and even fertilizer that farmers in Palestine can't use, it's banned by the occupation. How important is it to have this kind of farm in your community? What are your thoughts on kind of, you know, growing what you can grow in the little amount of land that you have?
Yes. As you can see, the Palestinians don't have anything, but only have a ground. So it's a very good ground. So all you have to do, what we have to do, it's to start into an agriculture. So we start into build this farm from many years. So it's become succeed year by year. It's successful.
Yeah, so it's quite short-lived. Small tree, and here will be
Thomas, a volunteer from the United Kingdom, plants new saplings in a terrace garden overlooking the valley.
This is the tree nursery, really. Along here we've got some vegetable beds. Things like ful, fakus, kusa, like sunflowers. About 30 different vegetable crops, all grown together very intensively, like sown right next to each other, but at different times. So as one crop comes to fruition, you can take the fruits or the leaves and then leave the rest.
Tell us about what kind of plants you have germinating here.
Here we have a collection of Palestinian native tree species, woody plants. We've got in total about 70 species, and in addition another 40 species of non-natives, which we might be using. Don't know yet. Many of them are already sort of naturalized. We collected the seeds locally. Some of these seeds come from as far away as like northern Iraq and Kurdistan, Turkey, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, because the trees of these species have become locally extinct. So here, as part of an agroforestry system, we hope to be harvesting like all the customary food crops, all the traditional, like, you know, vegetables for the recipes, but also firewood and fuel and other materials like oil for as a fuel, as a lubricant, like olive oil, fibers. You can make charcoal, and all the trees are also improving the soil. They're like binding it together, nitrifying it. They're bringing up nutrients from really deep and making it available on the surface, and they also change the microclimate. So once you've established some of the hardiest trees, you can bring in species which require a slightly more ameliorated environment. But all of them are native, so they're not going to require irrigation beyond establishment. But for that, we've built a 90 cubic meter rainwater collection cistern at the top of the wadi. So then we can provide like probably 2,000 trees this year with drip irrigation, and then they'll require no further irrigation.
Wow. And why were these native species wiped out? What can you talk? Maybe like here's where politics and agriculture intersect, yeah?
I really don't know the story. The rumour is that about 200 years ago, this, like the southeastern part of Beit Sahur, was still like oak and pistachio forest, the likes of which you can still find patches of around Bethlehem, mainly up in the mountains. But here down at the foot of the eastern slope, it's very dry. Desertification and soil erosion have been occurring for literally thousands of years. But the exact history of like when these tree species disappeared and like how the forests were cut back, I haven't been able to find out. Don't know.
And maybe for you know, audience, describe kind of the tenets of permaculture and why it's important to bring permaculture practices here to Palestine.
Yeah. Well, permaculture's it's an old idea. It's coined a new term for. I mean, you could replace the term with common sense, in my opinion. It's about sustainable living, be that as part of an agricultural system or just, you know, domestically, even if you don't have access to any land. It's about using what you've got where you've got it, trying to get the greatest return on the least amount of effort, trying to minimise the amount of resource that you're consuming. It's about placing the kind of components in your living system in sensible places so that the output from one component is the input to the next. And so the effort and resource just dissipates spontaneously from your centre of activity to the periphery. It's pertinent here in Palestine, more pertinent here than anywhere else I could think to work. And I have worked in other places. I mean, why aren't I doing this in England, where I'm from? Well, here I think it's crucial. It's, in fact, perhaps the only way that there's going to be any wastewater management, treatment, solid waste management. The government has no sovereignty. The municipality, they're bound by the restrictions of the occupation. They can only act within Zone A, even then. And so it falls to the people. If everybody here is distressed by the lack of water and the constant loss of land and the ever-decreasing ability to provide you know, food nationally, you know, for the domestic market, due to lack of water mainly and land confiscation. So if people are to address these issues which are worrying them, then they have to act themselves, because no higher agency is capable of, for instance, building a sewage treatment plant, because it's not permitted. So it's never happened. Like, I think there's one in all of the West Bank. Neither the settlements nor the Arab towns and villages have any wastewater treatment. So people can change to compost toilets, as they were using just 50 years ago. Like, our compost toilet here is the original. We didn't build it. We didn't have to do anything to it. We just started reusing it. It was well designed to begin with. So, yeah, we're here in the Bustan Karaka project, where we have an experimental centre, basically, to try to find like techniques to address these problems, just very like elegant, low-tech solutions, very cheap, which, you know, individuals or small groups of people can, you know, build quickly, just using the soil, using the earth, and using the native species. And in this way, you know, we hope to help people to take back control over such vital things as water and food provision for their families. And at the same time, we can protect the Palestinian environment and even begin to remediate the damage that's been done, because it's in a pretty pretty poor state right now. It's been suffering something of an onslaught of pollution and erosion and just basic degradation and desertification there. The climate's changed and many of the soils have degraded. If you walk out into the Judean desert to the east here, you can see like Ottoman farms on very barren ridgetops, which I don't know, I infer to mean that once the kind of the fertile agricultural land, the humid soil reached further out to the east than it does today, I think what's happening is the Judean desert's creeping up the mountain slope into Bethlehem, and that's happening region-wide. So although land like this is now considered marginal, and it's considered something of an expensive hobby to try to farm under such challenging conditions, people need to learn how to farm this sort of semi-arid farmland successfully, because globally it's increasing in area with global climate change and, you know, desertification. It's a global issue, like many of the issues here in Palestine. they're not unique to Palestine.
In the occupied West Bank, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Alice, an environmental scientist from the UK, helped start the Bustan Karaka farm in Beit Sahour. She explains why it's a vital community and cultural resource.
This farm was started by a group of friends, including me, partially as a response to working. Three of us had been working at the Applied Research Institute of Jerusalem, so we'd been working in the Palestinian environmental development sector and environmental monitoring and reporting. I myself have been acting as a consultant in water development. And we'd spent a lot of time, I guess, writing reports about the environmental crisis in Palestine, the awful state of degradation that was occurring, the development freeze. And a lot of the time we were writing these reports, we had to write, okay, the environment is being destroyed and nothing is being done and no one can do anything. You know, because of the permitting system and because of, like, funding situations, all of these reasons, you know, a lot of, like, political blockages, so that we could see that on the sort of top-down development model, nothing was happening to prevent the destruction of Palestine. From being part of that culture, I guess what we wanted to do was create a culture of, instead of saying this is terrible, something must be done, saying this is terrible, what shall we actually do now? And kind of getting away from the top-down development idea that, like, okay, this has to come from, you know, we need a lot of money to do this, we need to involve Europe and America. And I mean, of course, certain, like, aspects of that sort of development could be very effective, and it would be much better if they could implement the projects that they want to implement in Palestine. But I'd become pessimistic about the chances of progress on that. And it was like, well, in the meantime, what can we do? So what we're trying to do here is just, like, develop simple things that anybody could do to kind of salvage something from the environmental situation. And that relates to water conservation, to rainwater harvesting, to waste management, sewage treatment. And yeah, of course, the other thing we're responding to is the economic crisis and the food security crisis, and a situation that, as I understand it, is one of Palestinians being turned into dependents. It's a situation of total dependency. I think it's a lesson to learn from Gaza. It's a tool, a political tool, that Israel uses to enforce an agenda on Palestinians. And in our opinion, there are ways in which action could be taken to give Palestinians a little bit more freedom, you know, because I think, you know, looking at Gaza, Israel controls everything. No, there's no control in Gaza. They control the fuel, they control the electricity, they control the water, the food. And, you know, if Gaza is disobedient, we've already seen what happens. You know, this is just used as something to hold over them and behave. And in the West Bank, I think there's a process, I don't know if you can call it Gazification, I mean, that's a stupid word, no, but it's something like this. It's being shattered into small fragments, the land is being removed from people, like, there's ghettoisation, people enclosed into ever smaller spaces. And I don't know, perhaps it's paranoid, but I don't think it's so paranoid looking at the facts to say that Israel is trying to create the same situation in the West Bank, and it's about control. And in our opinion, Palestinians have the right to resist this. And some of the things that we're developing here, they're both good for the environment. They give people more stability, more control over resources. You know, the idea is that people can get everything they need from the environment around them. And yeah, I don't know, if I can quote a friend of mine who's a Bedouin who does much the same work, like in Bedouin communities in Israel, he says, with these things, this environmental movement, this is a case of us recognising ourselves. This is us recognising our own rights and saying, yeah, we don't actually need anyone to give us these rights. It's our country and these are our things and we can live here.
Can you talk a little bit about, from that idea of sustainability and agriculture translating to sustainability and resistance in the culture itself on a political level, what this kind of farm and this kind of ideology, what that does for this community and the Palestinian community in general?
Well, I think that, I mean, firstly, on a very basic level, it's a case of people taking care of their needs. Now, like, I've read the food security report from 2008, and this isn't a movement for yuppies, you know. This is like, to us, it's a very grassroots concern. These are real problems that people are facing. Like, there's so many Palestinians who have water problems, and increasingly, there's so many Palestinians who can't afford vegetables for their families. Like, this is what the report from, like, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Programme, and UNRWA is saying. People are increasingly on life support, right? They're just having basics delivered to them. By the refugee agencies and by Western aid agencies, and actually they can't even afford to supplement that. So this is like an immediate question, like how do we get more food? Well, we suggest that people could grow it. Even like we're trying to develop ways of doing this in an urban context. I mean, it's the next step actually, like everything moves a bit slowly, but we really want to look at rooftop gardening and like water reuse, like for refugee camps, these kind of ideas. And the other like other huge concern, of course, is rainwater harvesting and creating more water storage, because everyone needs that. Like in the summer here, there's barely anyone who doesn't at some point experience a water outage. And like obviously the more storage you have, the more stability you have. And like you can combine that. So if you build rainwater harvesting, you're immediately building storage. And then that storage, once the rainwater is used, can be used through the summer just to stabilise your water situation. So yeah, I mean, this is very basic level. This is like everyday concerns. And I guess, I mean, this is the fundamental point of the project. But at the political level, what does that mean? Well, it means that people are more able to exercise their basic freedoms without like being faced with the repercussions that Gaza has faced, perhaps, where you know, if you misbehave, your water supply is cut off. you know, this is quite a good tool for controlling people, no? And it like generates fear, because being without water in the Middle East in the summer is no joke.
Meanwhile, in the Israeli settlement colonies and everywhere inside the Green Line, they have swimming pools and hot water every day and all this.
Yeah, there's a very clear case of inequality in access to resources. And this is something that is not being addressed. Like, environmental justice as a whole is not addressed. It's not on the negotiating table. To me, it's absolutely fundamental to the occupation. This is how they assert their control over the land and over the people. It's through grabbing resources. If you look at like Zionist documents dating back to before the formation of the Israeli state, like this was thought about and planned for, how to, you know, Zionists understood that access to water was absolutely key to establishing their state also. And they had planned to seize most of the water resources, and they've done so very successfully. Yeah. I don't think, from what I see in Israel, that they're about to hand any of it back. It may be unjust, it is unjust, but it's true that they're not about to give it back. You know, like Israel talks, I mean, Israel leads the world to an extent in technology for water conservation and water reuse. But if you look at any of their planning documents, what they are planning for is not to redress the balance with Palestinians, it's to cope with their expanding population. There is no plan to give water back. So how do Palestinians cope, and how do Palestinians plan for population growth or for having a farming sector? Well, in my opinion, all of these things are possible. It's just that Palestinians are forced into a situation where they have to be smarter. You know, Palestine could lead the world, actually, also in, like, arid zones agriculture, because, you know, like, I can't even remember what proportion of the farming it is, but it's over 80% of the farming is rain-fed. It's already, like, traditionally quite a sustainable agriculture setup. I mean, the trouble is that now also not only like adapting to a situation like where Israel controls all the resources, Palestine has to also adapt to climate change, which is great, as if there weren't enough problems already. But yeah, it's predicted that rainfall over this area, over the Middle East, will decrease by as much as 20% by 2050. And if you look at the downwards trends of the last 20 years, this seems to be true. Should certainly be prepared for it. But the question is, you know, with like permaculture techniques, there are crops you can grow, there are things you can do. And, you know, actually, I mean, as Tom maybe like mentioned, this farm is one of the, in the more arid sort of zones of Palestine. And we kind of chose it deliberately like that. I mean, friends of ours who are farmers in like Al-Walaja and Bet Jala, they have like much greater rainfall. And they're like, why don't you farm up here? It's much better. And
we're it's
like,
a challenge.
Yeah, sure, it's much better. But this is the thing, like the whole of Palestine might be like this in 20 years. And so, yeah, we're kind of looking for like what you do when it's like this, like what crops you could grow and like are there different ways of doing things? These kind of ideas.
Reporting on Earth Day from the Bustan Karaka farm in Beit Sahur, occupied West Bank in Palestine, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more information on the farm, please visit www.bustankaraka.org. BustanKaraka.org.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are honored to be joined now by Jose Montoya. Jose Montoya is a poet, a writer, a folklorist, an educator, professor of history, Sacramento State, and a friend of the late and great Cesar Chavez. Jose Montoya traveled with Cesar Chavez, was sort of a troubadour for peace and for the transformation of farm worker rights. Jose Montoya, this is the day we lost Cesar Chavez some years ago. Welcome to Flashpoints. How did you meet Cesar Chavez and what did it mean to your life?
Wow. Well, the very first time that I met or saw or was in a position to be where he was when I was a student at art school in Berkeley, California College of Arts and Crafts. And we had heard from some other students that were from San Jose that this movement was afoot of people trying to organize communities and that there was going to be a meeting in San Jose. We got a couple of six-packs and headed on out to San Jose, and yeah, sure enough, there was a meeting. There was an organization called the CSO, Community Service Organizations, and I guess he was either speaking to them or organizing, but that was the first time that I got to meet him and Dolores, and I think Richard, his brother, was there also, and we found out that we knew each other or had been in the same areas in our childhood when we came from New Mexico. My family settled in Delano, California. And my former, or he's passed away since, brother-in-law was a labor contractor. And so we got to meet then. And then we all went our different ways. And so when we went to this CSO meeting in San Jose, it was, you know, we were trying to remember old names and old people that we had lived with, or labor camps that we had been at, and that was the extent of it. We were, you know, very impressed with this young man who was proposing to organize what I call the unorganizables. Because a farm worker moves around. I mean, he's not in a place where he's working in a factory or someplace. He's follows the crop. So we knew we had a formidable task. And that was the extent of it. Then I wound up teaching high school up in Yuba, in Wheatland, in Yuba County. And at that time, my fellow teachers at the high school had gotten me into crazy kinds of things that I never thought of doing in the barrio, and that was going fishing and camping and golfing even. So I had learned about golf in the Navy, and it was just about hitting a bucket of balls and enjoying that, but I never took it up as a thing to do. I was playing with the high school teacher's friends of mine in an orchard, in a golf course that was next to this orchard, and there was this guy who seemingly seemed to be having a hard time letting some farm workers know some things, and I yelled over and I said, "Hey, I speak Spanish. Let me interpret for you." And the guy turned around and gave me the finger and told me to get lost and took off in his pickup. And the farm workers came over and asked him, "What was that all about?" He says, "Well, he said that if we go to that meeting tonight at the Catholic Church in Yuba City, he's going to fire us." I said, "Fire you for what?" "Well, there's going to be somebody from Delano coming to talk about organizing farm workers." And I thought, well, maybe I'll go to that meeting. And yeah, it turned out, of course, Cesar was not there. He had other organizers who came to the area. And again, one of the organizers and I grew up together in Fowler, California. This was Madaleno Boteos, Pancho Boteos, very famous in the movement of the farm workers especially. That's where I got hooked on this notion that perhaps farm workers could be organized. And I participated. There was another active progressive group there in the area called Operation Listen. And these people were anti-war and just kind of people that I enjoyed hanging around with.
What about Cesar Chavez in the initial meetings? What about this man stood out for you, and why did you want to work with him? And how did you actually work with him?
Well, it was about, you know, learning where the farm worker offices were going to be set up in here in the north, and we had one here in Sacramento, and of course Yuba City, Marysville area had one, and that was where we used to ask him to come and you know, tell us what it was that we should be about, how do we let people know the plight of the farm workers and the need for them to have some organizing skills.
Is there a story that you can tell us that sort of exemplifies why you thought it was important to join this man in this movement, a story about Cesar Chavez, as we remember him on the day some years ago that we lost him, Jose Montoya?
You know, it has to be the awesome task of organizing people that move around. I mean, this is not a factory, so those were very important pieces of conversations that we got from Cesar, whether it was on a march or at a meeting or going to the Filipino Hall in Delano. There was just, it was something that was happening and it was exciting, and those of us, regardless of where we were at this point in our lives, having been former farm workers, we found it very easy to help out in any way that we could. And again, you know, being a school teacher, what you do in your community is just let people know the plight of farm workers. And so there were some very liberal-minded people that weren't Mexicans but understood the plight of the farm worker who were very helpful in organizing food drives and clothes drives to take to Delano. So those were the early exciting times.
Wasn't part of the genius of that initial
organizing and forming the initial union, didn't that have to do with Cesar Chavez's ability to bring together Filipinos and Latinos as they had never been organized before?
That was the magic touch that he had. And people that came to help out in the lane, was some of them were veterans from the freedom marches in the South. So there was the first Rainbow Coalition before Jesse came around, and just the humbleness of this man. You know, I particularly remember in Delano, we went out to a lake that's near there in Kern County, I guess, Melones Lake, I think, or something. Anyway, you know, he felt very comfortable slicing a big watermelon, taking off his shoes, and just sit on a carpenter's horse and talk about the plight and the need for people to be treated a little bit more decently.
Was there any hesitation for amidst the Latino community or the Filipino community to resist this kind of, if you will, integration to form a union?
There was. And of course, one thing that I maintain, and he was very adamant about, but we don't hear too much about it, the Filipinos were the first ones to want to organize a union. Larry E. Leong and Filipinos from Delano, he would give them full credit. And it's something that later on, I guess, got lost. The fact that it was the Filipino single man in Delano that first walked off the fields.
As a singer, as a poet, as a troubadour, as a cultural worker, was Cesar Chavez interested in having the culture and the music a part of the organizing?
It was one and the same, and that's also at that point in time that I became good friends with a man who later baptized one of my children, and that's my good friend, what's his name? Oh my God. It'll come to me, but he was with a troupe, Teatro Campesino, Agi Lira, Agustin Lira. During Easter week, we didn't have school. Schools are closed for Easter, so I left the Wheatland and joined the Farm Workers March. I think that was 1965. They had marched up to Stockton, and so I joined them in Stockton, and I walked all the way to the Capitol with them. And during that time, we. Those of us who had lived in the Leno and knew that area, in the evenings, we would sit around and talk and see the performances, live performances by Luis Valdez at the Teatro Campesino. So those, that week, marching into the Capitol, by the time we got to Sacramento, I had met so many people that I knew before I became a teacher from the Valley, from Fowler, Fresno, and Delano, Bakersfield. So marching up to the Capitol, by this time I had been made the people that direct the marches or help direct them. There's a name for it, for those guys, march captains, I think they're called. So I marched into Sacramento up the stairs of the Capitol there with my red band with the black eagle on, and there were people there who said, "Montoya, what are you doing? I thought you were up north teaching high school." I said, "Well, this happens to be a week where we'd have any school, so I went and did what I thought I had to do."
You did what you thought you had to do. Jose Montoya is a poet, an educator, a professor, a writer who worked closely as a cultural worker or troubadour with Cesar Chavez. We are remembering him today. Cesar Chavez, born March 31st, 1927, died April 23rd, 1993. This is the day of his birth, and we're delighted that you can be with us, Jose Montoya. Before we let you go, comments on the current situation around Homeland Security, the sweeps, the attacks on millions of undocumented workers and their families, more deaths at the border, people being forced into situations more difficult to get into the U.S. Tell us about your thoughts now on this.
Well, the situation is so dismal and degrading and such a disaster that something big has to happen, and I'm not sure exactly how that's going to manifest itself, other than this is an agricultural part of the country. California needs farm workers, and something is going to have to be done because there's no stopping them. They can build all the fences they want. They can do whatever they want. We know how to get under, over, and through whatever obstacle. We've been doing that forever. You know, that's how my grandparents came that way. And so it's not going to stop. So somebody has to intervene and do something about that situation. And I'm not one who has the answer. All I know is that when my people need to move and feed families, they find ways.
All right. Jose Montoya, as we said, poet, educator, painter, teacher, professor, friend of the late Cesar Chavez, and we are remembering Cesar today, April 23rd, about 15 years after we lost him, and we are delighted to have a friend, somebody who could give us a little insight and the importance of this man. Thanks, Jose Montoya, for being with us on Flashpoints.
It's been a pleasure. You guys have a good day. Viva la huelga.
The UFW was the beginning. We attacked that historical source of shame and infamy that our people in this country lived with. We attacked that injustice not by complaining, not by seeking handouts, not by becoming soldiers in the war on poverty. We organized. Like the other immigrant groups, the day will come when we win the economic and political rewards which are in keeping with our numbers in society. The day will come when the politicians will do the right thing for our people out of political necessity and not out of charity or idealism.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.